My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Like, the most ridiculous thing to me in the world is that race is a social construct, which means that it's not biologically real. Yes, your ethnicity, like, yes, I'm, you know, you've got Nigerian blood. I've got blood from Benin. You know, these things, you know, your German ancestry, that is real. But the black, white color divide is something that we made up deliberately to oppress people and to privilege certain people. But the idea that race can be predictive of outcome, that race can actually be, that can be quantitatively, statistically linked back to, you know, to looking at, to predicting somebody's future, how much money they're going to make. The fact that, you know, if you live in a certain zip code, we can tell way more about your future than we can by, you know, by just other human conditions. It's startling. You know, so institutional bias has really, really far-reaching impact. And again, we don't have to be victims of it. That's, I think, one of the most important messages. Like, when you look at it, it's scary. If you do your homework and you go back and you look at, you know, you look at this data, like right now I'm reading Stamped from the Beginning, and oh my gosh, it's like, what we have been through to get here is so much, and we also have a long way to go. And I think that's why, you know, why people are so upset, because we want to believe that we've come so far, and we have. You know, we are not in the same type of shackles that we were before, but we are all in a different kind of shackles. And the crazy thing is, you know, it's not just about the historically marginalized and, you know, and the oppressed and the people at the margins.
How you dare? That was the voice of Dr. Jana, and I love today's episode because a lot of you always ask me, what is my day-to-day like? What is it that I do with my career as a diversity consultant, as a speaker, and a cross-cultural coach? And a lot of what I do really is what Dr. Jana does. We both have diversity practices where companies bring us in to discuss how to mitigate bias, attract diverse candidates, but also create an environment of inclusiveness. And today's topic is all about bias, individual bias, as well as institutional bias. How does this affect every fabric of our lives? You're going to hear a lot about her story. You're going to hear about how we both are kindred spirits. And you're also going to hear about why it's important for us to really understand, acknowledge, and move past our biases. I hope you enjoy the episode, and I hope it leaves you with many, many pensive thoughts, but also clues on how you can make this world a better place. We literally can reshape the world into a better environment. So why not? Okay? Enjoy the episode. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of As Told by Nomads. And today's guest is Dr. Tiffany Jana. She's the CEO of TMI Portfolio, which is a collection of socially responsible and interconnected companies working to advance more culturally inclusive and equitable workforces. She's an award-winning diversity practitioner. In fact, I first heard of her when I was reading her book,
overcoming bias. And it was very, excited to see that we were connected on LinkedIn. And now today we're going to be talking about her new book, Erasing Institutional Bias. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Pleasure is mine, Dr. Jana. So tell us about you. How did you even get into the field? What was early life like for you?
Early life actually starts at the beginning. I am doing what I like to say that most people on the planet are doing, which is the work that my parents do, or my mother does anyway. So my mother is actually a practitioner of diversity and inclusion as well. So I came up watching her be a mompreneur and making change in the world in this particular way as well.
That's awesome. And so what was it like growing up with a diversity practitioner? Because I know I grew up as the son of a diplomat. And I observed a lot of things, and I actually turned that into a talk. I called it The Art of Diplomacy, but it filtered its way into how I saw the world. But you ended up doing exactly what your mom does. So I'm just curious as to whether you always knew at an early age that you would see the world through that nuanced lens. And what was it like when you were hanging around with your other friends? Were you the kid that was looking like, hey, that's inappropriate to say? What about this kid? Open up. No, let's hear that person. I'm just curious about that as a young lady.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I did see The Art of Diplomacy and I loved it.
Oh, thanks.
And I immediately felt, you know, a very strong connection to you because growing up the child of a diplomat is very similar to growing up the child of an army officer. So I was an army brat and I was moving all around the world and having to fit into those environments very quickly. And so I saw a lot of parallels there. And yes, I think that once your young mind has been opened up to an inclusive way of seeing the world and the various lenses of diversity, whether you're looking at in yourself internally, your family, or the whole wide world, you know, from the outside. And once you have that kind of exposure, you can't unsee it.
Yeah.
And so for me, the most profound way that it showed up, like I definitely noticed the differences in the way that people were treated. Like I spent some formative years in Germany and I was the only, you know, Black person, the only American person in German schools. And I very quickly was able to see that, you know, the Czech children were treated differently. The Turkish children were treated differently. And I found myself on those margins. I never really found myself in a lot of situations where I wasn't treated well. But I have this, you know, I have this weird filter of being a little bit less concerned with what people think about me or what they might say about me. I focus my energy on how other people were being treated. And I spent my time defending being the champion of the otherwise defenseless. So I was I saw the bully and I would bully the bully to get them to back off of the little guy. So, yeah.
No, we're such kindred spirits. So, okay. So you touched on it there. That idea of bias, this is something that can be a trigger word for a lot of people. And I also run a diversity and inclusion practice. And a lot of times, you know, I lead a lot of unconscious bias workshops. And when I bring up the term bias, sometimes people react with, what, you call me sexist, racist, or bigot? And, you know, and I tell people that, you know, it's actually something we all have, right? This is something that our brains, you know, needs to have in terms of whether it's protecting us or making sense of the world. But what has been your opinion? I mean, your first book was all about the individual bias, overcoming bias. What is your thought on bias and how it shapes our world today?
I mean, it is a programming, both internal and external. Like you said, there's a survival, the survival parts of our brains are the first influence. And then everything is data. We're taking in data all day, every day. And I think that, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate that it has such a bad reputation and that people get defensive and think that it's an accusation. It's really just an observation of the human condition. It's not an indictment. And just because you have bias doesn't necessarily mean you're going to act on it, but we do all have it. And I think that it's those, you know, it really is those formative experiences that lock down and ingrain the initial biases that become our kind of standard operating procedure or the initial programming that runs through our code. So if your, you know, your parents or whoever raised you, the, you know, the good folks that you were around, and maybe the not so good folks who you were around, they, you know, imbued you with certain ideas, certain beliefs, and even in some cases things were unspoken, but as, you know, as human animals, we pick up the energy that's around us. So if I'm a small child and, you know, somebody walks, you know, across the street in the direction of us, regardless of what they look like, you know, you can fill in the blank with whatever your mom decides is scary, and she clutches her purse a little more tightly and holds your hand more tightly, you're immediately going to get the signals on a primal level, on a visceral level, that whatever that person is equals scary. Yeah. Without her ever saying a word. So whether, you know, whether your parents were saying you can't play with that kid because they are fill in the blank, or the silent signals, the nonverbal cues, we're picking that up all the time. And we're even more sensitive to it, I think, as children, because that's when the foundation is being laid. So the foundation for bias was laid a long time ago. And I think that as adults, we have the responsibility to actually unearth some of that stuff and make some choices about what we believe.
Well, that leads to my next question. How do we overcome this? Because I'm sure you have experienced this, and I've been on the other side of perpetuating bias, and even though I try not to do that. But, you know, when I first came, I have that intersection of being Nigerian and confused as African American. And so, you know, people would sing the Lion King songs, or people would ask me for my credit card. Although they would hide their wallet, like, oh, you're going to take our credit card, you Nigerian prince?
Wow.
Or, you know, all these things. And it's, you know, when you experience that, like I did from the age of 10, right, when you find yourself in an American international school after going through a dictatorship, you're like, oh, wow, this is a lot of change. Mm-hmm. And then your food is made to realize, like, oh, it smells bad. Your hair is too curly. I'm very curious about ways that, one, parents can become aware of it within themselves, and teachers can do the same before they can actually help the people that they you know, shepherd over do the same. Are there methods to be more aware, and are there methods to unlearn these things as you're teaching people you mentor?
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you focused on the young people, because that would be ideal. Like, you and I, as diversity and inclusion practitioners, find ourselves probably very often working with, you know, mostly formed or fully formed adults and trying to undo a lot of, you know, bad programming. And that would, ideally, we would have these conversations and we would teach these lessons earlier on. So the first thing to recognize is that no one is going to eliminate bias entirely. You cannot erase it all from your consciousness, from your being, even if you're able to, you know, do some phenomenal work and eliminate, you know, most of the biases that you think you have. New ones are going to pop up behind them, because again, it's the functioning of the human brain. So the first thing is it really does start with awareness. There still, unfortunately, is a critical mass of people who are under the very misguided belief that they just don't have any bias. That's those defensive people who get upset, right? Are hoping and praying and believing that they don't have bias. And so the first thing is really to internalize that and just understand that not only do you have it, but it doesn't mean that you are a horrible person. It doesn't mean that you're broken. It doesn't mean that your parents were racist, or that you're racist or biased or sexist or whatever. It just means that you are a human being.
Yeah. And the acknowledgement of that, I think it's key. I think we live in an interesting time where we're simultaneously getting to finally call out some of the systems we have in place, but we're also in a very call out culture where it's reactive.
Yes.
And so people are now afraid, which is interesting. It's such an interesting paradox. I've always said we need to reconcile paradox, because they've always existed throughout ages. And so the better we become at realizing that paradox exists, it will be better for us. But, you know, Me Too, time's up, and then you're at a time where, you know, someone will be like, ah, wow, I don't want to apply for this job because old tweets about me can surface, and then that could cause me to ruin. And then now I'm going to hide this then, and that curtails growth, in my opinion. So, and it's such a tricky nuanced balance, because there are people that do need to be called out and do need to be potentially just put in jail for what they've done. And there are also people that are actually missing out on growth because they're afraid of maybe monetary consequences. And so that leaves you and I at an interesting space where We're encouraging people to be vulnerable or encouraging people to address these things, but we're not in control of other people's reactions. How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, I mean, it's that's the big challenge, because, you know, in all of this work, we don't get to dictate how other people respond. We don't get to control that. So my you know, first invitation to everyone is, you know, you've got to focus. This is why we have to look at ourselves. We have to take responsibility for who we are, how we act, and how we treat people. And again, if we can start with our young people and get them to be aware of, you know, you need to think about what you're putting on social media. You need to think about what you're putting into the world, because it is only the space that you occupy that you have any control over whatsoever. That said, you know, I am optimistic, and I do believe that we are moving towards a greater consciousness, and that as these, you know, events unfold and we are, you know, sort of watching these massive movements unearth behavior that are less than stellar, I think that, again, if you think about recognizing that you have bias because you are human, we also need to recognize that any of us, each of us, is vulnerable to, you know, to mistakes. Yeah. When no one is perfect, and whether it is you who gets exposed for a mistake that you've made in your life or someone you know and love, I think that the greater lesson and the opportunity here is for each of us to invite more grace into our hearts. We need to have more grace for each other, because, like, I happen to be Christian. I, you know, identify that way. And so biblical wisdom, you know, is sort of accessible to me. And so it's like, there, but for the grace of God go I, right? It could be you. It could be your sister, your cousin, your mother, your father, your aunt, your son, who is going through that same thing. It's very easy to gossip and judge when it's far away from you, but it is, you know, only but for a moment, a blink of an eye, and it could be a lot closer. And you would want people to have grace for you. So we need to have more grace for each other.
Absolutely. And yeah, we're going to dive into institutional bias very soon. I guess we've talked about understanding the problem there, which is, first of all, everyone acknowledging that we all have biases, and then doing the work to figure out our biases. Sometimes the problem does then becomes, well, I don't have any bias. How do you put yourself in a position where you confront your bias, one, and then you then find tools to work in bias? Some people might say, look, I have this bigoted view. I've talked to people who have told me, I went to school in Virginia, so sometimes, you know, it wasn't necessarily the pigmentation of preference in some of the places I went to. And they're like, hey, look, you're one of the good people, right? But I don't know what to do, because I've only surrounded myself with people that look like me. And every time I see, this is a real conversation, every time I see one of you, it's always some argument or some rap video. And, you know, how can I normalize myself? And taking away the offensiveness of the way that question was framed, are you saying that people need to start taking more agency and accountability and saying, hey, explore your curiosity more and actually try and ask yourself for other perspectives of the stories that you've been taught or inculcated, indoctrinated with as a kid?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is where proximity becomes really important. So you and I serve as ambassadors for our races, right? And for our ethnicities and nationality. And so people want to make us the exception, because for whatever reason, we represent things that they are comfortable with. We represent perspectives that are closer to their own, and they have otherized, you know, either Black people or African people or African Americans or whatever, so much that the notion that someone who looks like us could have so much in common with them or resonate with things that are good is actually disrupting their status quo. It's actually creating cognitive dissonance. I think in those moments, the opportunity that we have is to help them see the discrepancy and challenge their own beliefs and help them recognize that we are not the exception, that there are many, many more people like us. And what those folks are lacking in those moments is proximity. You know, I like to point out that we are more segregated now in the United States than we were in the height of legalized segregation. And when you don't have proximate relationships, real day-to-day interactions with people across the differences and across spectrum, then it's very easy to take the media's word for whatever people are going to be painted as. It's very easy to, to take other people's word for whatever it is that people are going to be stereotyped as. And we really need to stop relying on external indicators and external depictions of people and cultures and various demographics. And we need to start forming relationships with people who are different from us. And that was definitely the greatest gift that I received from that third culture education that I had, right? That you and I both experienced, is that while I was able to see all of those differences at a very, very young age, I was also very quickly able to see how much we actually had in common. And no one will ever be able to take away the humanity in my fellow person. I see it. I feel it. I know it. I know that you are my family, whether you are Republican or Democrat. I know that you are my brother, whether you are Black, white, or Asian. People need to have more experiences to make that real.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that. And that's so true. I love how you talked about us being aware of the external and understanding the impact of relationships, because what happens is when we don't get enough external, or we believe some of the external things, we've dehumanized people. When you dehumanize, it becomes easy for you to just dismiss. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Institutional bias. Let's talk about that. That's your book is called Erasing Institutional Bias. And for anyone listening, please get this book. I just went through my 100 books that I read last year. This was one of the books. So check it out. It's a good read. And, if you like audiobooks, the audiobook's also a good read, but it's a great way of breaking down what happens in our institutions today. So can you tell us why you wrote it and what it is about?
Yeah. So after writing my first book, Overcoming Bias, which was really written from the perspective of the individual, how do I find my biases? What do I do about them? The sort of natural outcropping from there was, okay, well, now I can see unconscious bias a little more clearly, and I can see it operating at a larger scale outside of myself. What do I do if I'm just one person, but I can see bias operating at my, at my company, at my church, in my community, in my society at large? So I wanted to provide people with some guidance in these situations, which can appear so incredibly daunting when you are one person, particularly if you're not the CEO of the company or the pastor of the church. You feel even less empowered to make change at these large scale levels. So I wanted to provide people with some guidance for how they can make inroads against bias when the bias is coming from external forces.
Yeah. And it goes to your earlier point. You said, which is the most fascinating stat. I've heard people say that, I've seen it, I've investigated it, but I'm sure people will be shocked by what you said. You said we're actually more segregated now than we were at the height of legalized segregation.
Yes. And that is exactly, that is a demonstration of the institutionalized bias over time, where we have actually codified things, created things like redlining, and created things that further separated us, and that the legacy of that, the long-term, generational impact of the biases that used to be legal and enforced in with legalistic structures, that structural bias has far-reaching implications. And the crazy thing is that when we look at where our society is today, and a lot of people are, really keyed up and activated after this last presidential election, the reality is that we are exactly in the, in the world of our making, in the America of our making.
Yes.
This was designed this way. And so I wrote Erasing Institutional Bias because I want people to recognize that we can have an alternative. There are other ways to be, but we are going to have to design it every bit as deliberately and intentionally as the garbage state that we're currently living in was designed.
Yeah. This is something I believe wholeheartedly. I think much like we individually need to acknowledge individual bias, I think institutions, countries, religions, everything, I'm a Christian as well, but they need to acknowledge the role they've played. And a lot of times I see a lot of accountability being passed, and I've always said, as is a product of colonialism, which British rule and divide and conquer with tribalism, I see the long lasting effects of that, where your tribe, it's almost more important than whatever you're doing. It's an indoctrination from your parents. It's the same thing with religion. And sometimes we, even in places like South Africa, some of the scripture was altered in a way where you are dehumanizing people. So all these things filter their way into society today, into redlining, like you said. And for those that don't understand redlining, it's a way housing was structured to separate white people versus black people. I see this and I'm like, no one has even acknowledged the role they played in this at first. Mm-hmm. For anyone to even understand what's the problem. And do you agree that people need to acknowledge this first and just sort of like decide what the next step is?
Yeah, because there's, you know, this conversation, you know, and conversations like this really upset people because it challenges their notions of everything that they understand and know and believe. And so, like, just as I do in my diversity practice, people need to lead with data. Stop taking people's word for it. Don't take my word for it. Go look it up. If the idea of redlining and the fact that people deliberately valued neighborhoods that had people of color as less valuable and refused to give, you know, people of color loans, which allowed them to not be able to benefit from owning housing and property, which creates generational wealth. Like, you can go back and you can look these things up and you'll realize that it's not about opinion. It's not about conjecture. It's not about politics. This is the reality of our history. So understand where we've been, understand how these conditions were created, and continue to look at the data surrounding the impact. Like, the most ridiculous thing to me in the world is that race is a social construct, which means that it's not biologically real. Yes, your ethnicity, like, yes, I've, you know, you've got Nigerian blood, I've got blood from Benin, you know, these things, you know, your German ancestry, that is real. But the black white color divide is something that we made up deliberately to oppress people and to privilege certain people. But the idea that race can be predictive of outcome, that race can actually be, that can be quantitatively, statistically linked back to, you know, to looking at, to predicting somebody's future, how much money they're going to make. The fact that, you know, if you live in a certain zip code, we can tell way more about your future than we can by, you know, by just other human conditions. It's startling. You know, so institutional bias has really, really far-reaching impact. And again, we don't have to be victims of it. That's, I think, one of the most important messages. Like, when you look at it, it's scary. If you do your homework and you go back and you look at, you know, you look at this data, like right now I'm reading Stamped from the Beginning, and oh my gosh, it's like, what we have been through to get here is so much. And we also have a long way to go. And I think that's why, you know, why people are so upset, because we want to believe that we've come so far, and we have, you know, we are not in the same type of shackles that we were before, but we are all in a different kind of shackles. And the crazy thing is, you know, it's not just about the historically marginalized and, you know, and the oppressed and the people at the margins. What folks have to understand, and what people like you and me who've been able to live around the world and really experience culture and humanity in a different way through a different lens, what people have to understand is that when, you know, when part of the human family is hurting, it's hurting all of us.
Everyone.
So whether you're black, you're white, you're female, you're male, you're gender nonconforming, whatever it is, when we are treating people differently and creating systems that reinforce, you know, oppression, all of us suffers for it. And I don't think people realize that. They feel like, oh, it's not affecting me, so it's not a big deal. You have no idea.
That is 100% correct. And you put up something. You said race is a social concept, construct. And the interesting thing is that it's so true. It's a social construct, but racism is real, which is such a weird, it's the weirdest paradox. Racism is real, but race is a social construct. And then you talked there. I just wrote a poem that's because I write a lot of poems, and one of the things that I talk about is history. And I said history doesn't have to be a mystery, but one of my final lines was, just because some of us fear what history might tell us about our current traditions and heritage doesn't mean we shouldn't tell complete stories of the past. And I've seen this because, you know, whether it's Thanksgiving, Columbus Day, or just telling Black history from the time of slavery, or not telling a lot of Native American history or Latin America or Asian history. I've seen the effect of how that can have kids and people in workplaces when they're hiring feel like you don't have any contribution. I never learned anything about what you do, what you've done. So my bias is going to be impacted because I don't think I want to work with you. And so this institution of bias, your book, which why I love it, is so important, is because it dives into occupational, racial, gender, hiring, customer retribution. And all these things all start from from exactly what you're saying. It's we are in some sort of shackles of our own doing that we can now, free ourselves of if we just say, hey, we've clearly done some things that have been wrong in the past. What can we do collectively to tell your story more and more? You know, that's why all the Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians, which I watched four times each last year, were so important, because I've been lucky enough to know where I'm from, being Nigerian and tracing my history there. But I went to movies, a lot of people were saying, wow, that's possible. You know, that's a representation of Africa I haven't seen. And the Crazy Rich Asians is the first all Asian cast since Joy Luck Club, which is it's not even the whole of Asia, just a part of Asia. So I'm just rambling now, but I really was affected by the point you were raising, that this institutions that we have to have, media, parents, schools, workplaces, there is a level of accountability that we all have to just address, and we all have to get uncomfortable. I think a lot of times it favors maybe like, oh, you're going to ruin my Christmas holiday, or you're going to ruin my Thanksgiving, but you can have those holidays and still tell the truth.
Exactly. So, I'm with you. You're not rambling. You are sharing the wisdom. Like, this is, these are the conversations that people need to be having. And the fact that we have created a tension in society that is making people, like you said, just afraid to be able to, pursue their dreams, to better themselves, to really step out there. And I would love to see some of that fear.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Dissipated so that people can have these conversations safely. And again, that's where that grace comes in. We need to be able to include folks from all different backgrounds into these kinds of conversations and be prepared for them to not get it right sometimes, to sometimes mess up, whether it's your, just like workplaces. I have to encourage people to create space for failure, because you don't get the innovation. You don't get the best of the human experience and the human brilliance and intelligence if you don't allow for failure. And we have to do the same thing socially. We have to understand that we're going to bumble and we're going to bump against each other in ways that are uncomfortable, but we've got to create the space to do that as long as we're all in pursuit of growth. So I don't encourage people to just walk around and say any old dumb thing. But your intention really matters. And if you are being intentionally inclusive and you're trying to understand and you're trying to connect and you're trying to grow, that intent goes a long way. It's one of those nonverbal cues, just like when mom clutched the purse and grabbed your hand really hard. when you, you know, when you step into, you know, a diversity pile of doo-doo and you say the wrong thing and you use the wrong pronoun and you slip up and use an antiquated, you know, nomenclature for something, if your intent is okay and you're willing to stop and apologize, acknowledge when you recognize you've messed up, don't hide from the mistake. Don't run away. Just say, hey, you know what? Like, whether somebody called you out or you call yourself out, I realized that I bumbled that. I got it. I did not do that as well as I could have. Please allow me to correct the mistake. And, I apologize. Just, you know, own it and try to move forward. And again, if you're on the receiving end of it, try to have some grace for your brother or sister, because being human is hard.
Yeah, it is. It is. And many times we don't let other people be human.
No.
Yeah.
No, it's easier to let your friends and family, and I call them the relationships that have legs, right? When you've got skin in the game and you have a reason for this interaction to go on, it's so much harder to have that kind of grace and compassion and patience with people we barely know. And I dare say we need to extend that grace a little further beyond the comfortable relationships.
Absolutely. And I think we judge ourselves based on our intentions and others based on the outcomes. Mm-hmm. And we sometimes forget that, you know,
right.
it's interesting, but I'm an optimist as well. And I believe that, I think we're in a good place. I think this is, you know, people always say, how can you be an optimist? But I grew up in two dictatorships, so I'm like, you know, I'm fine. But I've seen worse than this, but I love when mirror images are put in front of us where you actually have to be uncomfortable, because maybe it's because I was uncomfortable for a lot of my childhood and it suited me well. The identity crisis is ultimately what I built my career out of. But I think it's also a wonderful, opportunity for growth and collaboration. So that's why I love that. The audience might have heard me say, oh, occupational bias, racial bias, gender, hiring, customer and retribution. This is a lingo for both of us, but what are those types of biases that you're bringing up in the book and why are they important so that the audience knows?
Yeah. So I would say that the, you know, racial bias and gender bias, I think people are pretty familiar with. These are the ones that get a lot of the press. But I feel like things like customer bias and hiring bias might be a little bit more nuanced. And then retribution bias would be the one that people would be least familiar with. But customer bias is, you know, the idea that you have an idea of, you know, what your customer, looks like, what is the profile of your customer. So, you know, frequently when we talk about diversity and inclusion, people are, sometimes they come to it realizing that they need to have access to more markets, more different kinds of people. And if you think about it in something like, if it's a product, then you just want, you know, if you look at the customers, the commercials for products, you might see, you know, a certain kind of family, or you might see certain demographics using products. When in fact, lots of different people could, would, or do use the product. So you want to expand so that you don't limit the reach of your product. If you think about nonprofits, and like the nonprofits function based on donorship, right? And if you are always targeting older white men for donors because you think that they're the only people with money, you might be missing a huge donor base just because you're limiting who you think your donor is or could be. And so that's one of them. Hiring and advancement bias is more about who's getting hired and who's getting promoted. So a lot of times people can see that, you know, they'll actually reach out and they'll say, you know what, Dr. Jana, we have a challenge. Our company is, you know, really largely one demographic or only one demographic, and we didn't mean to do that. And so that might be evidence of a hiring bias. So you keep sourcing people from the same universities or from the same network. So you've got to expand that reach because, again, your bottom line will be affected. Your relevance in the community, your relevance in the marketplace will be affected if you don't have diversity represented. Advancement bias shows up when you have, let's say you actually have diversity in the organization, but if all of the, you know, the diversity or the different kinds of people are concentrated at the lowest level of the organization, and then as you go up, it all becomes more homogeneous, that's probably an advancement challenge because, you know, and typically I'll go ahead and name it because I'm being vague on purpose because the assumption is always, okay, so it's white males running in the organization and all the black people are at the bottom of the organization. But if you're talking about homogeneity, like diversity can be a challenge. If you have an all black organization, that's not going to be, you know, diversity representative. And if you look at the top of the organization and it's all African Americans and you've got, you know, all Asians who are doing the work at the lowest levels of the organization, that's still a diversity challenge. So the groups with the big numbers tend to win. So it tends to, you know, black and white and, you know, black and Latinx and white and Latinx plays out a lot, but it can show up in any way. And again, with a global perspective, if you look around the world, what makes the majority and the minority and who's on the margins changes within a context. I do think, though, that the biggest contribution that we've made in this book, Ashley Diaz Mejias is my co-author. She and I, we were really excited for a moment because we thought we coined the phrase retribution bias, but it actually did appear in someone's research. They didn't really expand it very far. So our contribution to the body of knowledge is expanding the idea of retribution bias, which is, simply put, the human tendency to favor punishment over relationship, to favor punishment over rehabilitation. And the biggest example that we use in the context of the book is the criminal justice system in the United States of America, where we've got really disproportionate numbers of African Americans within the penal system, much higher percentages than you have in the whole overall population. And, you know, people serve their time, but their sentence isn't over. Like, people get out of prison, they've done what they were supposed to do, paid their debt to society, and treating them as second and third class citizens long after they've actually served their time.
Wow, that was deep. And congrats on expanding that definition. Favor and punishment plays itself out when we do the call out culture. We were talking about that before we hit record, and there's a tendency to want to sort of say, well, you did this, you did that. I'm going to dig up tweets from 29 years ago and figure something that you've said, just because, you know, I guess it gives us some sort of satisfaction. But if I play devil's advocate here, I know I answer this question because I get this question a lot, but I'm putting myself in the listener here. Hey, well, I want to diversify my organization. I recognize there's an advancement bias, for example, but my pipeline is so thin and we recruit from such and such. How would I even fix that? That keeps me at a loss of words. And that's one question. And then the other question is, this is a family owned business. What do you want me to do? Give it outside my family? So those are two questions. What do you say to those things?
So the answer to both of them actually is very similar. The relationship between the two of them is myopia. It's short-sightedness, right? And so, yes, if you look at your current condition and you look at where you are now and you say, well, I can't make anything different because this is the current state of things and so be it, then sure, then you can live in that place. But if you are the owner or an executive at an organization, you're supposed to be taking a long view. You should be having some kind of visionary idea of where the organization is going, where you want it to be, and the values that you stand for. So now, you know, this is not an imperative. People can do what they want. If you want it to be a, you know, small family-owned business forever and you don't ever want anybody outside of the family to be in it, that's totally okay. Good luck with that, because at some point you really probably do need to have people outside of the family, just because if the company actually grows successfully, you can't make babies fast enough to populate the company. Right. And at that point, when you're talking about bringing in people, you can make a choice to be inclusive. You can make a choice about the practices that you're going to engage in when you're looking at hiring and advancement. If you don't make a choice, the unfortunate default with the way that the human bias is wired and way that our societies are, is that you're very likely to end up with something that is homogeneous, something that is not representative. And it's not, it might not be out of intent or malice. We default to our networks. We default to what we know. And if you go back to the earlier point that we made about our society, particularly in the United States, being more segregated than we've ever been, then you understand that if you don't have those relationships and you don't have diverse networks and you don't have proximity and therefore, you know, relationships that help you see the human potential, no matter what package it comes in, you're less likely to look for it, seek it, and hire and grow in that way. So you have to be intentional if you want to really be inclusive, or you have to look for, you know, people and recognize that when you find talent that maybe does look like you and have a lot of similarities with you, but they actually have really diverse networks and they think differently than you in this way, you have to understand that that kind of inclusive outlook is every bit the asset of a, you know, an MBA or a doctorate degree or 35 years of experience in the field. You might not be the one who has that inclusive outlook, but when you find it in other people, you need to understand that that's an asset and potentially hire for it. As far as the pipeline piece goes, again, it's the short game, right? If you don't see it now, the pipeline is thin, what am I going to do? We've been having these conversations for years. And again, if you're an organization looking to grow, then you need to be thinking about the future. I've got, you know, clients now and, you know, potential clients who, you know, if they had started nurturing the pipeline 10 years ago, when they first started having the conversation, they'd actually have a crop of, you know, emerging college students now who would be, you know, early career, but ready to hire. So if you don't have a pipeline or you don't see what you're looking for, create it, contribute to it, use your volunteer time to go get in front of, you know, students of color, to get in front of, you know, women and girls who could potentially go into tech. Show the world, particularly the marginalized world or the underrepresented world, what their options for the future are, and they'll try to find paths to get to you. And if you have the resources to smooth that path and actually, you know, seed that path, you will go a long way towards creating your own pipeline. You will outcompete all of your competitors by nurturing that pipeline and building those relationships early on.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I always say to my clients. And sometimes they might push back, like, we got to make profits. But I think what you said, it hits the nail on the head. It's you could create your internship program. You could go to, you could partner with the local school. You could say, hey, this is our day where we're doing this. Whenever you're recruiting the colleges, don't just stop at the, like, the career office. What about the affinity groups? Like, you know, the, you know, African American group, the Latin American group, the Asian group. There's so many ways that you can get creative if you really wanted to make that, you know, I guess if it was a core value of your company, you know,
exactly.
That's how you know the difference between you just said that or you really want to do that. Because I think the misconception is that diversity and inclusion is easy. The idea that people from different backgrounds are not going to experience conflict or it's not going to be hard to convince someone to come to a place where they don't see enough of themselves is misplaced, because it's nature. We're tribalistic. You said we have our biases. We categorize things naturally anyway. So if you don't come across as, you know, honest or authentic, it's really going to be easily sniffed out. So and then I love the point you made about hiring for the talent that you're seeking for. Maybe make that a full-time job for someone.
So. Yeah. And the other thing I would say that I like to make sure people know when we're talking about the pipeline, because, you know, I understand the pace of business. I've got 3 companies, for crying out loud. It's fast. And if you're successful and you're doing it well, you know, it moves really quickly and it's can be hard to see the forest for the trees. So the other option that people have that they, you know, overlook is, for whatever industry you're in, whatever field you're in, there is any number of professional associations that are related to the job functions that you're trying to fill. And for every professional association that exists, there are several of them that are divided out by affinity. So if you've got, you know, if you're looking for a CFO or an accountant, you know, the National Association of Certified Public Accountants, you know, there's one for African American accountants, there's one for Asian accountants, there's one for Latinx accountants, and so on and so on. With every professional association you can think of, there are groups of minority subsets of that affiliation and that association that are getting together on a regular basis. They are always looking for content, connections, networks, speakers. Find out where they are, find out who they are in your city, show up and say, hey, I've got this company. We're growing. Even if you're not hiring at the moment, go build the relationship and say, you know, we're not hiring now, but we will at some point. And I'd love for your members to be aware of us. Like, yeah, a little bit of effort goes a long way.
It does. It does. We're talking to Dr. Jana here, who's the author of Erasing Institutional Bias. Where can they get Erasing Institutional Bias?
You can get it at erasinginstitutionalbias.com. You can get it on Amazon, on Kindle, Audible, everywhere books are sold.
That's amazing. If you want to hear more of these amazing conversations, you should definitely check her out. You should also check out TMI Portfolio. Now, when I first discovered your work, it was a different iteration of your company. But you've since evolved. I think you're doing more artificial intelligence and machine learning and things like that, right?
Yeah. So TMI Consulting was the first company, and now the portfolio of companies includes Loom Technologies. So we are actually, we've put metrics behind diversity, equity, and inclusion. We're measuring, mapping, and improving organizational culture using the power of artificial intelligence. And we're really taking diversity to the next level because we've got metrics and accountability in an industry that really doesn't have much of that.
Yeah. So how would that work? So someone like me might need some metrics. I'll come to you. Is there something I buy, or how does that work?
Yeah. So we would put your organization through an organizational assessment. So people would, you know, just take that at their, for now, we're in beta. We're headed to MVP, but people would sign up online. They would go through an assessment, and we would deliver, you know, kind of scorecards and, you know, results for folks, and then for the organization. And we would give them a roadmap that gives them step-by-step instructions on how to get the organization from where it is to where it wants to be. But we map out the culture, and we look at, you know, 80 different interpersonal and organizational competencies across 11 categories. We're measuring things like bias, emotional intelligence. And I think that as a CEO, like I want to know, one, what is my ROI for what I'm spending on this diversity and inclusion stuff? And if I can quantify how much, you know, emotional intelligence I have in my sales department, or how much bias I have in my marketing department, that can help me with really targeted interventions. And we do everything from the diagnostic part all the way through the intervention and the improvement.
See, no, I love that. And so you're not only an optimist in our you know, current racial justice world, and you're also an optimist in the artificial intelligence world. So that comes with its own share of interesting opinions as well. What makes you an optimist with AI?
Well, I understand that, you know, particularly since I am measuring bias, I understand that code itself is biased and artificial intelligence is biased. And so we're working really hard to make sure that we have, you know, code of color and, you know, women code and LGBT code. We're trying to diversify the base of people that we work with on the data analytics side, on the, all the computer science side, because again, you can't eliminate it entirely, but, you know, code is inherently biased because we, you know, if we stack too much of our tech dependency in the hands of single demographics, then the bias becomes a much larger scale systemic problem. So we're trying to address that. And that is that's a nut that we're all still trying to crack. Nobody has a single solution yet, but we are mitigating against that risk.
Yeah, and that's good. It's good. It's good. I mean, it's almost like you do this for a living. You have the right answers. I'm like, I'm going to stump Dr. Jana now. She's like, oh, well, technically we. Okay, so this is interesting for me. I always like to pull up fun facts. I did in your first book. I remember you saying that you are in an interracial marriage.
I just completed my third and final marriage. I am a free and independent human.
Well, you and Jeff Bezos are in, you know, you've completed that iteration. But the reason why I brought that up.
Wait, are you going to get me an introduction? Is that what that is?
I mean, $68 billion, if that's what goes down, is going to be. No, but I guess the reason I brought that up is you've been in non-interracial marriage and an interracial marriage. Uh-huh. And I'm always curious about the dynamics and how that plays with children, because do you find yourself having to, you know, answer different questions with the kids, or do you find yourself having to deal with people of color saying you sold out or things like that? And I'm saying this because I've heard every iteration from "you sound white" or "you're, what are you doing for your people" type of thing. And I'm very curious about how you navigate that, because I get a lot of those questions, and it's always interesting to get those from people like yourself.
So, I mean, the first thing I'll say is that I'm sure people have a lot of things to say to me, but very few people will say them to my face. There's something about me that people don't really want to confront. So they're welcome to it. But in my case, I would say that the white man I was married to, I met him working with my mother's company. And so he was a white anti-racist. And so he was very, you know, steeped in the work. He was the co-author for the first book.
Right.
Whatever questions anyone might have had about that interracial relationship, it made sense. It was equally yoked because we were doing racial reconciliation work and sort of world unification work as a livelihood. So we were, you know, literally and physically a embodiment of racial reconciliation. Too bad it didn't work out, but I hope that that is not a foreshadowing for what's going to happen with the rest of the earth, but.
Oh my gosh, I love this. No, it's interesting. I just brought that up because it's something I have two brothers. One is married to a lovely lady from Florida and Alabama, and she's white, and I've seen him deal with it. And there's nuance being Nigerian and being black and being in the South. So I live in New York, so my experience is a little different, but I always see that, and I just wonder sometimes.
I mean, early on, so we were together for almost 10 years. And in the beginning, at that time, there were not a lot of interracial couples that were really visible in Richmond, Virginia, and particularly not in our pairing. So much more common, it was, you know, black man, white woman. But to have a black woman with a white man, you know, back then, a decade ago, here was nowhere near as common. And there are only a couple of instances that stood out. Like I remember my oldest daughter was at a very elite private school. Right. And, you know, when I was a starving artist and, you know, I was a divorcee, I was single. I was, you know, very, you know, just probably just a cute little token Beyonce parent who was in the environment, right? There were not a lot of students of color at all. When I was married to my second husband, who was Ethiopian, like, you know, he was tall, dark, and handsome, and everything was fine. No one batted an eye. But when I showed up to that school with a white husband, the attitude of particularly the women around me changed dramatically. Mm. And it was really weird. Initially, I thought maybe it was that they were concerned that if I was with a white man, that my black daughter would be interested in their white sons. Mm. And I thought maybe that was it. And then, a friend of mine disabused me of that notion. She was like, no, Tiffany, no, they were worried that you were going to take their white husbands.
Wow.
And when I went back and thought about it, I was like, oh, yeah. I mean, I was a model and an actor and, you know.
I mean it's Dr. Jenner, right? I mean,
maybe that's what it was. But
look,
I thought
her up.
Thought that was funny.
that's fascinating. I love your perspective, your sense of humor. But yeah, I mean, I brought that up because it plays into many insecurities that sometimes do stem from bias. Actually, a lot of times they stem from biases. And I want the people and the ladies and gentlemen listening to the podcast to understand that whenever we bring up bias, it's not just some, oh, two diversity professionals talk about this. This is something that affects every asset. Every facet of your life, you know, from the decisions you make, who you marry, what you do, where you live, you know, what you read and things you surround yourself with. And you're going to find those unconscious thoughts coming into your mind. You might not have thought that you had a problem with something and you're like, I reacted differently. And so I want to invite the audience to sort of question those things within themselves and say, well, why did I just say that? So,
I think the other thing that puts me in mind of is the, attributional ambiguity. And that is the notion that, you know, particularly when you have a marginalized identity or intersecting marginalized identities, you know, when stuff like, I don't know what those women were thinking, you know, they might have all collectively just randomly had weird days and bad days. And maybe the Botox went sideways and they were just making that funny face for a different reason. I don't know. But when you represent, you know, any kind of marginalized identity and, you know, unfortunate things happen or people say weird things, you can't really actually attribute it specifically to anything, but you know that you're having an experience. And this is why, again, race is predictive of outcome and racism is real, because that kind of uncertainty that is always paired with negative treatment, it causes anxiety, high blood pressure, exacerbates existing medical conditions, and creates conditions because we are sensitive as human beings. So this stuff is very real. We have study after study after study that show you that prove that how you think about, you know, a person, an animal, a situation can actually affect the person, the animal, the situation. Your silent musings are not going into a void. If you believe that certain children in your class are geniuses and are smarter than others, they're going to perform better, even if you don't think that you're acting on it. You actually are.
This is so true. I love this stuff. Energy and all of that. So I'm going to put the show notes. I'm going to make sure I put the link to TMI portfolio as well as your books, because I imagine there are going to be a lot of questions that people have from this. But I could talk all day, but we have to stop now. So
no worries.
but is this a testament to your ability and your well intentioned career as well as just well practiced career, because it stems from you observing your mom, and then you've just elevated it with being more inclusive of different perspectives. You know, whether you bring in esoteric religion and different things like that, you're able to sort of have this conversation from different perspectives, and I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for that compliment. I appreciate how thoughtful you are.
You're welcome. So my final question is a reframing of my mission statement. So my mission statement is use your difference to make a difference. And it's the foundation of everything that I do and act. So I'm always asking my audience the question, how do you, Dr. Jana, use your difference to make a difference?
So the interesting thing about my differences is that each of them really stands at an intersection. I am, you know, I'm not the darkest black person or the whitest white person. I'm not the straightest straight person or the gayest gay person. I'm not the most feminine or the most masculine. I've got these identities. I identify in the middle of so many spaces. You know, I'm not the most Christian or the most atheist. I have both through, you know, genetic identity, personal identity through, you know, physiological DNA and whatever it is that causes these different things. I've landed at the nexus point of so many different identities that my differences serve as a bridge. I understand the perspective of the Republican and the Democrat, the conservative, the liberal, the gay, the straight, the religious, the atheist. I understand every side of all of these different ways of being human. And I feel like the only choice that I have is to stand in the middle of that bridge, extend my arms both ways, and try to help people find each other across the divide.
Wow. Yeah. Bridging divides. Literally your physical embodiment of your values. That's always a beautiful place to be. Wow. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your humorous yet insightful insightful stories. I know that we're going to get a lot of chuckles, but also a lot of insight into the world that we live in today. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Tayo. This has been awesome.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, till next time, use your difference to make a difference.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to reach out to Tayo and to use your difference to make a difference, head over to www.tayoroxon.com.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.